Indiana's abortion ban temporarily halted, a study committee on cannabis, plus a new Ways and Means chair, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending September 23rd, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana's near-total abortion ban has been temporarily halted. Just 3 days after a judge heard arguments in a lawsuit challenging the ban, she ruled that the law likely violates the Indiana Constitution. Judge Kelsey Hanlon, who ran for the bench as a Republican, said there is a recognized right to bodily autonomy in the Indiana Constitution. The abortion ban has limited exceptions for risks to the life and serious health of the pregnant person, for some lethal fetal anomalies, and in some cases of rape or incest. Hanlon says the law goes too far in restricting the right to bodily autonomy by making that autonomy largely contingent upon first experiencing extreme sexual violence or significant loss of physical health or death. The ruling means that for now, abortion is once more legal for anyone up to 20 weeks. The state will appeal the decision. Are you surprised at the judge's ruling? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief for the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, this came down fast. Are you surprised by the decision?
I'm surprised that an Owen County Republican made the decision instead of a Monroe County Democrat. So let's start there. I don't think it's surprising. This question over whether privacy is a right in the Indiana Constitution has a spotty history, pro Roe v. Wade being overturned, with the Court of Appeals affirming it, meaning abortion is a protected right. The Supreme Court vacated it. That produced two dissents that had two opposite opinions. So the idea that this question needs to be answered isn't a shock to me. It shouldn't really be. I know you're hopeful that courts don't have an injunction on a law that was passed if you're supportive of it, but answering this question I think should be important. It's important for the pro-life community as it should be for the pro-choice community.
This opinion could have gone obviously one of two ways, and as Mike just pointed out, we have this debate about 15 years ago or so between two Indiana Supreme Court justices in dissents, mm-hmm. one saying, no, there's no right, one saying, yes, there is. And she mm-hmm. went with the yes, there is crowd.
Right.
What's the likelihood that this current Supreme Court goes with the no, there isn't?
Well, I think she thinks that the likelihood is that they're going to go with yes, there is, because it's a preliminary injunction, and you have to demonstrate a likelihood of prevailing on the merits in order to get that. So she clearly, with her reasoning, came up with the notion that, you know, all of these rights, as we've seen over the course of however many years this country's been in existence, evolve. And what may not have been, an attitude shared by a lot of people 50 years ago is now shared by a lot of people. And she's absolutely right. In the past, in other kinds of situations, the state courts have determined that the rights guaranteed by the Indiana Constitution don't actually mirror the rights provided by the federal Constitution. And in many cases, we're much more liberal about the rights that we recognize under the Indiana Constitution. So it's not surprising at all. I think as a Republican from Owen County, she deserves a lot of credit for following what she thinks the law is and should be. And it obviously will have some political risk to her in that county. But nonetheless, she did the right thing, and I think she deserves a fantastic amount of credit.
One of the things she points out in the ruling is, and something that Solicitor General Tom Fisher pointed out in the arguments, which was, even if you believe there's a right to privacy, or whatever you want to call it, in the Indiana Constitution, in that Article 1, Section 1, they really buried it. Even if you think that, abortion was banned in Indiana at the time the Constitution was written, and so therefore it cannot possibly be part of what's a protected right in the Constitution. And her point is, things have changed in the last, however, 200 plus years, or 100 and something 100 years. So, yeah, I'm not good at math.
We can tell.
But the point is, things have changed. Is that argument going to hold up?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the fact is, it's like women couldn't even vote when we, started this. So you can't really compare everything to exactly the situation when the Constitution was written. So I do think even so-called strict constructionists have to recognize that you know, life has changed. And the reason abortion and women and might not have been mentioned is because, you know, it was just never even thought of back then. Yeah.
The Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita's office is appealing this, hopefully directly to the Supreme Court. Their hope is that it'll go directly to the Supreme Court. It seems like a good chance that might happen on something like this. The Indiana Supreme Court doesn't really get into controversial issues like this very often. That's just not what the state court system generally covers. Not to say that they don't do any controversial things. Heck, last year they had Holcomb versus the legislature, which was pretty darn controversial. But this is a very different level from all of that. Do you think, realistically, that will affect their deliberation?
Well, as I've said before, they're not sealed in some sort of, you know, managed jar, impervious to any kind of input from the society around them. They are, last time I checked, all living, breathing human beings. So that's not to say they're going to be swayed by it. I think they will do their best to interpret the Constitution as the best they possibly can. But this is an undecided area. I mean, you look back at the debate that you just cited. There were two very well-regarded associate justices arguing very different things. Was Brent Dixon maybe was chief justice? Associate justice. I didn't want to rob him of chief status. It's a hot potato. Look at, I'm fascinated how we got to this point. I mean, it was filed in Monroe County, where all the judges, I believe, are Democrats, and the people
not by accident. That venue for
right.
a reason.
And you would think, you know, once Judge One says no, and they don't have to provide a reason in civil litigation as they would if they were recusing themselves in criminal trials, why they don't. But first person said no, second person no. Pretty soon it's going to the judge for the district to assign it, and in the order that sent it to Kelsey Handlin said, this is the only judge in the region, in the district, that can do it. And begs the rhetorical question, what if she weren't around? Everybody, I guess, could say no, and then that throws it, I guess, to an appointment of a special judge or retired judge.
I mean, nobody is jar full of judges.
Yeah, nobody's eager, probably, to tackle this. Let's put it that way. Kudos to her for stepping up and doing what a judge is supposed to do, which is, you know, whether it's calling balls and strikes or, you know, as Justice Roberts at the federal level likes to say, at least she was willing to step behind home plate and make some calls.
After 4 hours of public testimony, much of it conflicting, Indiana lawmakers appear no closer to deciding whether to legalize cannabis. The legislature has been examining the subject for about 4 years, and the testimony in a legislative study committee this week wasn't much different from what lawmakers have heard before. Katie Wiley is the chief legal officer for Stash Ventures, the parent company for cannabis growers and sellers in Michigan. She says, as a mother, she wants legal and regulated cannabis to help prevent a black market.
If my child got their hands on something, I would want to know what was in it. I would want to know it's safe, it's effective, and that there's a control around it.
But Indiana prosecutors and business community leaders, chiefly the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, continue to urge legislators to pump the brakes. Chamber Vice President Mike Riley says there's still no good way to determine whether someone is impaired because of cannabis, and he says that has impacts on the criminal justice system and the workplace.
The longer we wait to implement things, you know, more data comes out, we think time is on our side.
Both sides of the debate offered conflicting studies and data on whether cannabis legalization is better or worse for health and better or worse for public safety.
Ann Delaney, here we go again. Is there a catalyst that can finally prompt action on this in the General Assembly?
I don't know. I mean, sometimes you wonder if there are backbones in any of the people listening to this testimony and voting on some of these more controversial issues. Look, I mean, I thought a very good case made at least for medical marijuana for people with chronic diseases and veterans having trouble, and they don't even want to countenance that. So I think the only catalyst that could spur them to do something in the way of action would be if the federal government finally got its act together and legalized it. And they have to do that, because this hodgepodge we have of states doing it and the money not being able to be put in banks is resulting in all kinds of corruption and robberies and this, that, and the other thing. And it's just, it is a public it's interesting that legalizing it has become a public safety threat, not because of the marijuana, but because of the money coming from the marijuana. So I really think the federal government needs to step up, put their big boy pants on, since they're almost all boys, and do the right thing and legalize it.
As Ann points out, this is not as easy as just saying, okay, legalize it. It gets complicated how you set it up, how you regulate it, how you work with the banking community at the state level. Is the best idea then for Indiana to wait for the federal government, which makes some of those more complicated issues a heck of a lot easier?
I'm with Ann. I can't believe the federal government hasn't just reschedule it. And let everybody just go do. Let them go have that debate, but they can have it.
Yeah, you
with
want,
clean
you don't
air.
Have to tell everybody.
We were this close to a Trump attorney general starting to enforce this and say it's not really legal, right? And having a federal attorney general say that, not that we have the capacity to enforce any of this, but look, I think in the context of the state, the Indiana legislature, it is progress for a hearing to take place. It is progress for legislation to be introduced. Like, that isn't nothing in this debate for the legislature to make the political or the policy decision to have this conversation. And I think you're going to incrementally see more legislation be introduced, more players come into the state. That's new. Stash and other players coming into the state is a new dynamic in this. It was just a theoretical conversation before. Now you have players coming to the state saying, here's how we did it in Michigan. Here's how we did it in other places. And that brings credibility to the argument. And it gives lawmakers some context and really start to think through the details, which is a measure of progress, ultimately, for this
moment. Also brings money. In terms of contributions.
How many times do you have to listen to the debate, and how many times do you have to have the debate? Is it like daylight savings that we're going to deal with it for 20 years?
I think everyone understood turning the clock back. I'm not sure everyone understands the vertical integration and delivery system of cannabis.
I don't know.
Or how we do it.
Is that maybe the more complex part of this? Is that it's not as simple. I mean, daylight savings time was, are we setting the clocks back, are we not? This one is, if we legalize it, well, first of all, is it just for medical, or is it for adults entirely? And then setting up a regulated marketplace for it, is that going to be ultimately a bigger stumbling block in these last few years, presumably before it finally happens?
There are two stumbling blocks. One is federal inability to reschedule this. And as long as Eric Holcomb's governor and as long as people who feel the same way that it's folly for the state to ignore federal law and pretend because of banking concerns and other sorts of financial transactions, which all of a sudden are done in cash and it becomes kind of a wild, wild west, with six shooters on their waists,
That's a selling point for a lot of people.
That's a selling point. So that's an issue. But then beyond that, you can't just legalize it because the real money, the real bruising, legislative roller derby here is not going to be whether to legalize it or not. It's going to be how to divvy up the contracts, the licenses. We're talking lots and lots of money here, obviously. And those who get the foothold first are going to reap significant financial gain. That's where it's going to be. Very bruising, I think, more so than just the yes or no debate, which, again, is being held up, I think, largely by the federal government.
And what we heard again on this week was the money here isn't just okay, who's going to get rich? Some of it is also like, as many of the people who've done this in other states have argued, if you want to prevent the black market from forming or reforming, it's only a black market in Indiana now, but if you want to stop that from happening, that's going to how much you charge, like how your licensing systems work, how much you charge for some of the stuff. That makes a difference because if you make it out of reach for small businesses, that's where the black market then grows in a legalized state, right?
Yeah. I listen to part of it. I hear what you're saying, that you do think there is some progress being made. I mean, just from someone who's sat in those hearings, it sounds just the same as it sounded 2 years ago and 4 years ago. We've really gone nowhere on the federal side. You know, we still have a governor who, doesn't want to be involved in that until that's changed. I don't know. I don't know what the catalyst is in it. I agree. I guess there's some tiny incremental steps, but it ultimately sounds much the same to me.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question is a relatively simple one, I suppose. Should Indiana fully legalize cannabis? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, do you care if the candidates for Secretary of State have a debate? 75% of you say yes, 25% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana House Republicans have a new budget architect, 12-term Representative Jeff Thompson. Speaker Todd Houston recently appointed Thompson as chair of the House's most influential committee, Ways and Means. Each bill with a significant financial impact must go through the Ways and Means Committee, and the state budget starts there. More than 50% of that budget is education, which comes in handy for Thompson. He was a teacher for 30 years and led his caucus's efforts in recent years to rewrite the state's school funding formula. Political scientist Andrew Down says Thompson can't necessarily focus on further changes to the formula now that he's the House GOP's main budget writer.
But his awareness of the issues is certainly going to be beneficial.
Downs notes that the average Hoosier likely won't notice a difference in the budget process under Thompson.
The governor will still chime in. The Senate will chime in. Members of the House caucus will chime in. It's hard to imagine how there will be significant shifts.
Thompson replaces Republican Representative Tim Brown, who is retiring. Nikki Kelly, is Thompson a safe choice?
Yeah, I mean, and I think it also signals probably a more short-term choice, maybe one or two budget cycles. Obviously, Representative Thompson's been around for more than 20 years, so maybe they're going to try to put a younger person, on, give him sort of the
training
along the way.
Well, that's what they did.
Yep.
And the person that they were training was Todd Houston, who then became Speaker of the House. So it kind of derailed that whole plan of succession.
Yeah, and obviously Representative Thompson, he's got a lot of knowledge on the K-12 side. He'll have to bone up a little on some of the, other agencies, but I think he should have no problem this session getting through.
In talking to Andy Downs, Andy pointed out that Jeff Thompson kind of straddles the line of he's from a suburban-ish area,
or at least
the donut. Yeah, the donut counties, certainly. Yeah. Kind of a nod to the donut counties around Indianapolis. But he's got a foot in the ag community, certainly. He's a public school teacher. He kind of checks off a lot of boxes.
He does, and he gets the system. He understands the institution. He respects the institution. You have some people who just want to torch the whole thing and don't even like the idea that the state collects money. I'm maybe being somewhat hyperbolic, but not much.
Not much.
That the state collects money and then dispenses it. So
pays them.
So he is safe in that regard. And I think you're right. He probably won't stay as long as some. But this is, as committee chair assignments go, I was thinking back modern history, and I'll say modern history is basically, since you were running for us, okay, modern history.
If you were in D.C., he'd be a young guy. He'd
be
one of the young guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Modern history, which we'll say, have been five chairs. And there would have not been that many, except you had change of control of the parties.
Right.
So even there, it's an eight-year, average. Because I'm saying roughly 40 years.
Doc Brown was close to 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
As a lobbyist, we talked a lot before this decision was announced. We talked a lot about partly why it matters is you have all these folks out there, both in government and outside of government, who are trying to prepare their pitches on the upcoming state budget. And without knowing who that chair was going to be makes it hard to know how to tailor that pitch. How do you tailor a pitch without giving away too many secrets? How do you tailor a pitch to Jeff Thompson?
That's what he gets paid for.
The upside is you've been pitching him. For years, right? I mean, the guy, he had the office next
there.
To Tim Brown.
Yeah.
You know, this guy, it's not like he just got pulled out of obscurity. He's been on the committee forever.
Which wasn't the case with Tim Brown. I mean, obviously,
right.
He was the chair of the public health
committee. He was a surprise pick.
He was a surprise pick. This feels...
At the time, as a lobbyist, as the former Hendricks County Republican chairman, I love having a Hendricks County guy from Greater Lisdon, Indiana, the only Lisdon on planet Earth.
There you go.
So yeah, no, I think it's a good pick. I think it's continuity. I think it's stability. As a lobbyist, we don't love turmoil and surprises.
From a Democrat's perspective, is Jeff Thompson a good pick?
I think so, especially among the group that were eligible, yes, I think he's a good pick. I mean, he knows.
As close as you're ever going to get.
Yeah, well, he knows enough about how the bulk of the money for the state is spent. I just hope he has some vision and some ideas about how we deal with all the money that they have in reserve, with all the needs that are out there, and he's not going to turn into an abominable no man like Tim Brown was. It's time for us to invest.
Is that one of your husband's lines?
No, actually, I've never even tried that out.
Oh, all right. Sounds like something
no,
I would have called
no,
him on the floor.
No, but the point is, with all of that money, we need somebody that understands how the state works and has a vision for what the state could be and is willing to make the investments necessary to get us there. And I'm hoping that he's one
of those people. I would absolutely bet he has a vision for how that reserve should be spent. I don't know if you'll like that vision,
well,
but I bet he has a vision.
As long as it's not going to be some chicken whatever, half of a percent of a cut of something that, you know, so we don't have the money the next time we need it.
All right. Indiana, like many other states, has seen a recent increase in the number of women registering to vote ahead of this year's election, according to a report this week in the Indiana Capital Chronicle. The Capital Chronicle's story says there were a little more than 278,000 people who either newly registered or updated their voter registration since January. Data from the Secretary of State's office shows that of those people, 52% were women. Women make up 50.4% of the total state population, according to the Census Bureau. The gender discrepancy in registration was much sharper in other states. In Kansas, women registrants were 16 percentage points higher now than before the Supreme Court ruled on abortion this year. It's more than 5 percentage points higher in Idaho, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. John Schwannis, is Indiana's number enough to make much of a difference one way or the other this fall?
I think it could make a difference. You know, the challenge when you start to compare the disparity or the uptick with other states, then you have to assume almost that every woman votes the same way on this issue and is motivated primarily by this issue. And then you have to, once you make that leap, then you have to take another leap and say that everybody will turn out who is registered, which is another, perhaps even bigger, well, not bigger leap. They're both big leaps. So
if you don't register, you can't get to your next
Right. My point
weeks.
Is, we based on what we've seen elsewhere, and granted the numbers are not, we haven't seen as much of a groundswell here, but still, there is a force, there is something going on here, and not just from the data, which thank goodness you did the story, but it's good to know the facts, because anecdotally, I hear a lot of people, 20-something women, and even young men who are motivated by this issue and are in alignment, gender notwithstanding, are motivated perhaps to go to the polls this time around to a degree they haven't in the past. So I'm not willing to say, oh, it happened in other states because it was more than 5% uptick.
Yeah.
It could happen. I think that is a wild card in virtually every race this November in across the country.
The biggest jump, obviously, in Kansas, I mean, way bigger than everybody else. And there's an obvious reason there. They had a vote they had to take directly on abortion. We were the first state to pass an abortion ban in the wake of Dobbs, a new one. Are you surprised that the jump wasn't a little higher?
I thought it might be a little higher. What I found fascinating was the new registrations are still more men than women, but it's the updating. And so what we're seeing a lot on that is maybe lapsed female voters who were frustrated and they just gave up a couple times ago. And now they're like, you know what? No, I want my voice to be heard this time. Let's change my address. Let's get this going back. And that's where we're seeing more of the women come in, is updating their vote.
We are making a big assumption here, though, which is that the reason that these women are registering or updating is because of abortion, A, and it's on the cause of pro-abortion rights.
Mm-hmm.
Is that too big an assumption to make?
I don't think so. I really don't think so. And the other part of this is we still have another, two or three weeks for registration coming up, too. And that's
in
when
Indiana week, you know.
Yeah, I know. But that's when the tables get set up and the signs go up and that kind of thing. So it's going to be interesting to look at those numbers after the 30 days before the election.
If you're a Republican candidate, do these numbers give you pause at all?
Well, I've said before, there's a catalyst for some of these kind of purple areas. There's an issue that can be a catalyst, just like health care reform in southern Indiana was a catalyst for Democrats to change their voting habits. But in 2016, when I ran the governor's campaign, people would when early voting started and you started seeing these huge numbers turning out in largely Republican areas, people would twist themselves in knots with me, trying to explain that this was going to be a Republican repudiation of Donald Trump, and they'd have all these theories why that was. And I used to just say, look, I think if we're seeing historic numbers of Republicans voting in traditionally Republican areas, I think they're probably mostly voting Republican. And that's what wound up happening. So let's see where the early voting is. This isn't that, right? This isn't an issue versus a candidate, but we'll see. That's why we have the election.
Numbers like this make me think, I don't know if we'll see a huge impact on statewide races, but is the place where this could have more of an impact, because we don't know, of course, necessarily where all of these people are, is it on those smaller, if you will, state house races where something like this could have a bigger impact?
Sure. I think, I think generally speaking, those races are decided by issues that aren't the kind of headline issues. They tend to be, right. They tend to be, oh, that's my insurance agent, or that's my kid's teacher, or I know that person, it's a neighbor. This may be different. This is engaging people who either have not engaged in the past, or as you point out, might have have decided to sit the past few cycles out.
It could make a difference, though, in those donut county areas where we've got some strong women running.
Yeah, that's part of the key, too, as you pointed out before. If you don't have a candidate running, it's hard to make a difference.
Well, that's where those are the areas where they are. It's going to Republicans in urban and suburban centers.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.